Welcome to PEMBA On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. PEMBA On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of different healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare, career development, and healthcare leadership. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional or legal advice. The views and opinions expressed by me, the host, or guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization we are affiliated with. Welcome back to PEMBA On Demand, the live stream series sponsored by the University of Tennessee's Physician Executive MBA program. Today, I'm honored to welcome Dr. Lloyd Marks, physician, engineer, entrepreneur, mentor, and a proud alumnus of the PEMBA class of 2016. Dr. Marks brings a rare blend of expertise to the world of healthcare innovation. He holds a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from MIT, an MD from the University of Michigan Medical School, and of course, an MBA from the University of Tennessee. Over the course of his career, he has seamlessly merged medicine and engineering to become a pioneering medical inventor with over 20 medical device patents and multiple successful commercial ventures. He is the founder and medical director of MGI Medical, where he's working on commercializing a non-invasive device that detects shock earlier than conventional methods, a potentially game-changing tool in postoperative care and gastrointestinal bleeding. Dr. Marks has served as business mentor to countless startups and university tech transfer offices, and he currently advises academic institutions, investors, and inventors through his firm Medical Invention Consulting. He's also an entrepreneur in residence at the University of Tampa and a medical advisor for NeuroEM, working on novel treatments for Alzheimer's disease. From interventional pediatric cardiology to ski gear startups and scuba innovations, Dr. Marks continues to push boundaries with creativity, precision, and passion. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lloyd Marks to the show. Lloyd, welcome to our show. I appreciate you coming on the show tonight.
Yeah, thank you very much.
It's great to have you here.
I appreciate the honor, that very laudatory intro. I appreciate it. A little exaggerated, perhaps, but thank you.
I don't think it was too exaggerated, but I appreciate I appreciate the sentiment there.
Yeah.
But I'd like to kind of start with talking a little bit about your motivation for obtaining your MBA, and specifically maybe why you selected the PEMBA program when you decided that you were going to get a master's in business administration.
Sure. Well, it sort of goes back to when I graduated from college with an engineering degree. I had an NSF fellowship to become a PhD and a professor in electrical engineering. But this was the 60s, and the idea of working for a big evil corporation like Lincoln Labs or something was so horrible. And someone planted this idea about medicine in my head. And I got to tell you, I never was interested in biology. I was only interested in physics and things I could actually touch and understand completely. So I thought, you know what, I'll take a vacation for 4 years, I'll do some flashcards, and I'll get an MD, and then I'll somewhere along the line, I'll learn the problems doctors have. I really had no intention of practicing medicine at all. And I will eventually get to the question you asked about why PEMBA. So I'm what they call a rabbit hole guy. So I discovered that there was this other side to my personality that I just didn't fully understand. I loved the caretaking nature of medicine. I loved taking care of children. So I chose pediatrics. And then because I wanted to be in a field where I could use technology, I knew it had to either be either intensive care or NICU or cardiology. And I chose cardiology really because that way I could take care of kids of all ages, even adults with congenital heart disease. And it turned to be a great decision because when I was doing my fellowship at Hopkins, I happened to just be in the right place at the right time when interventional cardiology was introduced in pediatrics. I actually had my hand on the catheter for the first pulmonary valve dilation. So I was able to take that knowledge with me as I went to other institutions. And I always had joint appointments when I was in academia in both medicine and engineering. I was creating things, inventing things. The engineering students would build them for me. And I really liked that. That was a pretty rich time for getting patents. And then I became the director of the cath lab at St. Chris, and then the head of pediatric cardiology at Children's Hospital in New Jersey. And I was had a joint appointment with the New Jersey Institute of Technology. And I met a great fellow there, a guy named Mike Smith. And he liked what I was doing with my pulse floor meter. And we formed a company. And as I went on, I realized I don't know very much about running a company. And I better learn something. And I'd been passing by the Pemba booth at the American Heart meeting for years and years. And every time I passed it, I said, gee, I wonder if this is something I might want to do someday. Nah, no way. But then it just seemed right. And it was a 1-year program, so it was doable. And my goals were twofold. I went there because I wanted to learn how to run my company. I learned a little bit about that. I learned how to write a business plan, which I didn't know how to do before. And I also wanted to turn myself into a consultant who could provide advice to Wall Street folks who are doing due diligence in medical technology and startup companies and so on. So that's why I went to the PEMBA program, for those dual reasons.
So at what point in your career did you get the inspiration for starting MGI Medical? Did that occur during your fellowship or
no.
after you?
Actually, this is a story about tenacity. When I was a third-year medical student, okay, we're talking about 1974, somewhere in that, say, 4 or 5, I was following a patient who came in for an elective procedure for what was called a femoral popliteal bypass procedure to treat claudication. And so he was a retired engineer. I liked the guy. We hung out. We had a good time. He built conveyor belts. I really remember this guy well. I thought, wow, that's really interesting, conveyor belts. Mm-hmm. And he was supposed to go home the following afternoon. And the following morning, the med students are lowest on this totem pole, so we have to do rounds the earliest. So around 5 or 6 in the morning, we go to the bed. I distinctly remember turning to my friend and saying, this guy really shows us how much we have to learn. He's going home this afternoon, and to me, it looks like he's going to die. P.S., he had an occult bleed, and he had exsanguinated during the course of the night. I became obsessed with the pathophysiology of hemorrhagic shock to find that in that era and today, there is no way to know that your patient's bleeding to death. As shocking as may seem, the best way to do it is to put your hand under the blanket and feel the temperature of their foot. Mm-hmm. And I said, if I'm going to do one thing in my life, I am going to figure out a way to make a monitor that'll save a guy's life like this. And that's really how this all started. It was very directed at a very specific event in my life, a seminal event, changed my life forever.
So you mentioned tenacity. How long was it between that tragic event that inspired you to come up with a solution for this problem and when you were really able to put a product in the hands of somebody to test it?
Well, that's a very another story unto itself. I decided that I was going to leave medicine between my internship and what turned out later to be my residency. I left after my internship because of family reasons, and I just didn't know if I wanted to be a doctor really. And I got a job at NIH at the Lab of Technical Development, and I inherited a project called the Laser Doppler Flow Meter. And what that does is it shines a laser beam in the skin. The light interacts with moving red blood cells, and then the light that reflected back is Doppler shifted, just like the sound of a fire engine that goes past you. Mm-hmm. It's called spectral broadening. And it turns out that the spectral broadening is in the audio range, so it sounds a lot like an ultrasound. Doppler ultrasound, but it was in a, the lasers back then were rigid tubes about yay big. And we shined the light on a rat's heel pad with a mirror. And what I contributed to that effort was I said, look, if this is ever going to really work in a medical environment, we need to have it on a flexible connector. So I added fiber optics to it. And amazingly, it worked the first time we tried it. We put some fiber optics on it, it worked. But it turned out that the skin is a terrible place to make measurements because the skin is so involved in thermoregulation that just the motion of a person walking past the experimental animal prep would throw the readings off scale. So I kind of laid off of it for a while and decided to return to my residency in Washington, D.C. They happened to have an opening, as it turned out, a second-year resident quit, and they already knew me, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't work on this project at all for a while. And then when I was a fellow, training as a pediatric cardiologist, I was doing a project in order to earn a stipend for myself to continue my fellowship. And nothing I was particularly interested in. It was studying hypertension in children of adults with hypertension. And we wanted to see what the blood flow in their limbs was. And there's this awful technique that no one uses to measure limb blood flow called venous occlusion plethysmography. Since this is a physician audience, I can explain it briefly. You put up a cuff proximal to the limb. It occludes the venous outflow, but the arterial inflow continues. The limb expands, and it produces a nice curve. You can see the conductance of the limb expanding, but it doesn't work, basically. But when I was looking at the curves, I noticed these itsy bitsy little teeny tiny bumps on top of that curve going up. And they seemed to me to be occurring with the heartbeat. And then I went, aha, that was one of those light bulb moments. I went, aha, that probably has something to do with cardiac activity. So as an engineer, I knew how to get at that signal that I won't explain because it's a physician audience, but I knew how to track that signal. It's a little bit like auditory evoked responses. It's a signal averaging process. And then to my utter surprise, it was a very constant, reliable, reproducible signal. I didn't have any hopes for it at all. And then every time we tried it in a situation where you'd expect blood flow to go down, it worked. We looked at patients getting cardiac casts when they perked the vessel, and we could see the spasm of the vessel and see it return. And then we had our big break about, I don't know, about 9 years later. I got access to the Red Cross in Philadelphia. They normally do not allow researchers to approach blood donors because they're afraid it'll turn them off. But I kind of sweet talked the guy for a couple of years, and he finally said, "All right, you wore me down." And we did our first really great study. We did a statistically significant study of 35 blood donors. And in this type of a study, each subject is their own control. So you can do something called paired t-testing, which is very powerful. And with those 35 subjects, we could detect easily the loss of that single unit of blood that they donated. That was a big day. That was a really big day. But then I did lots of anecdotal things. I won't go into all the anecdotal tests, but it seemed to be working everything we tried. But I could not think of a clinical trial that I could come up with that I can manage on my own. And I saw, almost really gave up on it. I almost didn't renew the patent. That would have been a pretty bad idea. And then just to tell people how things happen, you got to just get out there in the world and things fall at you sometimes. I was at a family party, and this gal there is an ER physician. And she hears my story and she goes, "Are you kidding? GI bleeders. We hate GI bleeders in the emergency room. They come in. We never know what to do with them. We don't know if they're still bleeding or not. Could your machine tell us if they're bleeding or not?" I said, "It should. I mean, we'd have to try it." A couple of weeks later, I don't know what I had for breakfast. I was feeling very cocky, I guess. I said, "What's a great research institution? I don't know, Mayo Clinic." I called their GI department, and the head of their bleeding unit, the head of endoscopy, picks up the phone. And this guy, Andy Storm, he's what we call a smart guy. A smart guy understands what you're doing before you finish your first sentence. And Andy, before I finished my first sentence, said, "You got to come out here and show us this thing." And then the next sentence, they're telling you how to improve it. And it has been a wonderful relationship. I mean, I've become friends with Dr. Storm. Last conversation I had with him, he said, "We've got to finish this pilot study soon so I can publish the results."
So
And
where, oh, I'm
yeah,
sorry, go ahead.
no, I was just going to say, and that was a very important thing because we now showed that it actually worked in a clinical environment where patients are getting pushed around, needles, blood pressure cuffs. And we have one patient who came in looking pretty normal. It was the kind of patient you might have thought about sending home. But when we observed him for just a half an hour, his blood flow index, the thing that we follow called the compensated shotgun, has dropped by 35% in 25 minutes. And I was sure he was going to have a bleed, and he had a bleed, and it had to be cauterized. And then another patient came in with a serious episode of bleeding, lots of blood and low hemoglobin hematocrit, very low flow parameter. He was already in compensated shock, but it was stable. So I said, "I think he's probably stopped bleeding," and he had. Yeah, so that's the story of MGI.
That's great, and it's
And I was on the
fascinating
phone
for.
today with my consultant for military because the Department of Defense, one of their priorities is to have remote hemodynamic monitoring of soldiers in the field. And navigating the military is pretty complicated. So I found myself a great guy, a really good consultant. He has arranged for me to have interviews with the military folks in about 3 weeks. There's something called Soft Week in Tampa. Yeah.
So it sounds like you've gotten it to the point where you have pretty good data that it actually can do what you want it to do. So yeah. What, and you've got some potential contracts, it sounds like. So is that the future of MGI Medical, that you're going to begin producing this commercially?
And I certainly do. I mean, my dream really is for Medtronic to take it off my hands completely. I don't want to build a company. I don't want to reinvent the wheel. And I thought that was a ridiculous idea. And I'm a fellow of something called the American Institute of Medical Biologic Engineering. We were in Washington a couple of weeks ago, and I'm a member of their industry council. And the head of that council ran what he called a research blitz. You had 5 minutes and you could show one slide. And at the end of it, he comes up to me and he says, "How'd you like to show this to Medtronic?" And I said, "Yeah, I mean, they're not ready. We're just a company at the valley of death stage." He said, "Nah, I wouldn't be so sure." He said, "It's pretty compelling technology, and the market is so large, they might be interested." So I just sent him an email 2 days ago, and we'll see what happens. I mean, it'd be great if I could just have it taken off my hands.
So that's a pretty exciting evolution. Yeah. Coming, as you said, quite a bit of tenacity. Have you had any angel investors in this whole process? How have you funded this?
We are completely undiluted. My partners and I have spent probably about $2 to $3 million. We're tapped out. And my partners have got such patience. I mean, really, I think they wanted to ditch me a couple of times, but they stuck with it. And now that they see that there's some stuff happening, they were very much on board, because I said to them, "Look, I'll just keep paying and I'll dilute you guys out a little." They don't want that. They want to keep their 50%.
Oh, well, that's great. That's great.
Yeah. It's an exciting time.
Is this the only, you have 20 other patents. Have any of those other patents had a similar life?
Oh my goodness.
Track that the pulse flow meter has?
Not similar to that. No, but equally exciting. And in fact, very financially remunerative. It's such a long story, but I'll just try and make it summarize as much as I can. But one day I was reading a popular science magazine about this new alloy called nitinol. And it's an incredible metal, which has super elasticity. You can't kink it. And it also has shape thermal memory. You can take a nitinol wire and curl it up and then heat it at very high temperature. And then when it cools off, it's floppy again. And then when it hits its transition temperature, it returns to its memorized shape with great force. And now nitinol is used for lots of things. But back then, they didn't have a clue. They knew they were using it for underwires for brassieres, and they were using it for braces. So I'm reading this article. I remember sitting in bed reading this article. This is kind of cool stuff. And I said, "Wait a minute, I'm a pediatric cardiologist. I wonder if we could use this to close holes in the heart. And hey, those braces, that means it passed biocompatibility testing. That's a good thing." So I thought it was so unlikely to ever be successful, I actually disclosed it to the university and let them patent it. And then 4 years later, they didn't see any market for it. They gave the patent back to me. All I had to do was reimburse them for their patent costs if I ever made any money. And then I had something happen to me that never happens. No inventor ever has had that happen in the entire world. 3 weeks later, I got a call from a company, an honest company. "We're working on an ASD occluder. We ran across your patent. We think we're going to infringe on your patent. Let's talk a deal." We made a deal, great license. That's a story in itself, how we arrived at the license. But then another company, which you may have heard of, called Amplatzer, infringed on the patent and then started a legal process with infringement and finding foreign patents to try and invalidate mine. Anyway, 5 years later, the head of the patent office, the three-judge panel, gave us all 56 claims we had developed by then, and then it ended up forcing Amplatzer to settle, and we made a staggering amount of money.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is an amazing story.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing
story.
Yeah, life-changing event, no question about it.
Do you remember what your first patent was?
I sure do. It was a pop-up camping tent, 1977.
Wow. And so where were you in your training and education at that point in time?
I had just arrived in Washington, D.C. to work at the NIH when that patent.
Okay.
And then shortly thereafter was at what's now called the Children's National Medical Center. Yeah.
I've often wished that I had developed a pop-up tent, because I hated putting tents up when I was a kid because they were such a pain. So how did you get the idea to solve that?
Well, okay. I have a model of it somewhere here, but it had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 segments, and they were interlocking joints that would stop at a predetermined angle, and you would grab the middle one on each side. First, you had to put a stake in the ground, which was a bungee cord, and then it would go snap up like this. You walk around to the other side, boop, it would snap up on the other side. And my wife and I took it on with us on a when we climbed Mount Washington. And we were up at the top of Mount Washington, and we were in the middle of the cloud where the lightning and the thunder were. We bailed out, left the tent. We said we'll find it wrapped around a tree the next day. And we went hung out with a bunch of Boy Scouts all night. And then when we came out in the morning, the damn thing was still standing. So it was really good. But they have so many great, you know, lightweight pop-up tents now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
I almost licensed it to Eureka Tents, but the R&D guy was out of town. And when he came back, he had the NIH syndrome, not invented here syndrome. Uh-huh. He killed it.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if we could pivot a little bit, because one of the other areas that you're focused on quite a bit is this medical invention and tech consulting business. And I wonder if you could talk to the audience a little bit about what that business provides and who the audience is for that, who the customers are for that business. Sure.
So what I do is I provide consulting for the assessment, protection, the licensing, and the commercialization of medical technology. And my target audience is rather broad. It's, of course, inventors, technology transfer offices and universities, corporations that are evaluating new technology. I did some consulting for Datascope when it existed, when they were trying to decide whether to buy out another medical device company. They flew me out to California. We looked at them and decided that it was a ridiculous product and no one would ever buy. And then, of course, patent attorneys. And I'm forgetting a category in there, but there's like 5 different groups that I target the consulting work towards. Yeah. And right now I'm doing mostly volunteer work with the students at the entrepreneur centers at U Tampa and U South Florida.
So how did you get involved in the volunteer aspect? I know you were living in the Northeast.
You give me so many stories. I tell you, when I did the training, after I finished Pemba, I thought they're just gonna come running to me from Wall Street. Who better than me to give them advice about due diligence for new technology? I couldn't get a call returned. I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated. And I actually went into a clinical depression for a while. I thought I was useless. Mm. And when we moved to Florida to be near our grandchildren, I was driving down the street past the University of Tampa, which I'd never heard of before. And I see a building with a big sign on it, the Marine Daily Innovation and Collaboration Center. I said, I don't know, sounds interesting. I go upstairs to where the offices are, and their COO, within 15 minutes, he's got his arms wrapped around me. You have to become an entrepreneur in residence. So I said, sure, that sounds interesting. He then introduced me to this fellow, Chuck Papagiorgio, who's running a company called NeuroEM, which has discovered that the very same frequencies that are used in cell phones seem to dissolve amyloid plaques that are present in Alzheimer's disease. Now, they only have anecdotal data, but it's not too bad. I mean, they have a lot of data from mice that are genetically have Alzheimer's, but they have 8 adults and none of them have had progression of their Alzheimer's. And a couple of them have had real improvements in their cognition. I mean, one woman who she couldn't do anything. And now she's reportedly balancing her checkbook last month. So, I mean, there's something there. And Chuck has shown me just how hard it is to raise money, even when you have a really compelling idea. Chuck's had like 5 successful startups, and he's just an amazing guy. I always say he's my brother from another mother and the only man who makes me look like I sleepwalk through life.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than 1 calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. I want to go back for a minute. We got a question here.
Yeah, sure.
Dr. Leiter asked a question. How do you come up with the ideas to pursue to create innovation? Is there a process or do you just have a great imagination?
What it is that when I encounter something in my own life that is annoying and I think it could be done better, I just can't let go. I drive my entire family completely ballistic with this. It happens every day. I mean, literally every day. I'm busy creating a little thing to hold the pool toys. And I'm out there in the middle of the night with a drill and putting things. It's just, I just can't help it. And this thing with this is an idea brought to me by my son, who's the head of telemark skiing at Stowe, Vermont. He just came into me one day and said, Dad, you're an inventor. You know, the telemark skiers don't use the wrist straps because if the pole gets trapped, they can get a torn rotator cuff. So what I do that he would never do and that most normal people would never do is I'm like a dog with a bone. I built about 50 prototypes before I got a damn thing to work. And I was just up in Vermont last week finalizing the pre-production model with an industrial designer. Yeah.
So my next question, and I didn't prep you for this question, but right. how much of your residence does your wife let you have to take over with all of your ideas? I just thought of that because I have a hard time getting room for my ham radio equipment.
And, that's a very sensitive topic because my wife she's the opposite of me. Literally, and she's a Luddite when it comes to technology. And her office is still boxes, complete boxes. Mine is boxes, but I kind of know where some of the stuff is in the boxes. But I do have a lot of real estate. In my last home in New Jersey, we had a really big house, which thank God it's gone. And I had an office that was the size of about 2.5 bedrooms, had 3 parts to it. I had my normal desk space, I had an electronics area, and I had a place for doing photography, which is a major activity of mine as well. And we moved to this house in Florida, and there must have been a playroom or something upstairs, which is about 2/3 the size of my office in New Jersey. I was able to move everything into this office. I mean, I've been building furniture, bookcases, and file cabinets, and I still haven't got everything sorted out yet. And then the kicker on top of all of that, it looked like there was like a tool shed in the back where he could put a lawnmower. Turned out to be the guy, prior owner was a woodworker. It's like a 25 by 25, whatever that is, 20 by 25 square foot shop. I was able to literally take everything from New Jersey, including my drill press and my table saw and everything, and move it all in there. I don't know where anything is in there yet, but it's only a year later. But I've been doing all the ski pole stuff in that shop. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that was just kind of a funny question, but I figured there had
to be a story. No, it's not a funny question. It's not because the house for her, you know, because she likes to entertain, and it's a very modest house. It was a tiny house that they added a little bit onto. And a lot of our inner walls are actually cinder block because they were the outer walls. And in fact, it's funny how you come up with ideas. I was just designing in my head a way to enlarge the house for her. Yeah.
Well, I've got a couple more questions for you. And you've had experience in medical startups and non-medical startups. Is there something that makes medical startups different from other types of startups?
Well, I really only have one experience in a medical startup, and that's MGI Medical. Mm-hmm. That is my startup. And yes, very different, of course, because when you're creating a medical product, you have to deal with approvals, FDA, and you have to prove safety, efficacy, good manufacturing practices. All those things are very difficult, and that has to be built into your business plan. So my current business plan is to take our current device, miniaturize it for military use, and then once it's finally miniaturized, we're going to have a new type of electrode system, then to start the process of even thinking about the FDA. That won't be for at least a year and a half. I mean, I just hope I live long enough to see this thing used in a hospital.
The ski pole thing,
I could have that out of the market next year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
From an international perspective, is the U.S. and the FDA, does it make it more difficult to do a medical startup in the U.S. compared to the U.K. or the
yes.
or Europe?
Yes, it is. It has been standard practice for medical device companies to do their research outside of the United States and to get EU approval before they get US approval. That's been absolute standard practice. There was an ASD occluder that was made by, I think, Boston Scientific. I hope I don't get that wrong. And because Boston Scientific had introduced a catheter without doing a proper PMA, the FDA was punishing them. They demonstrated safety and efficacy, but they would never pass them on good manufacturing practice. So they ended up selling the rights to that to the company that ended up licensing my patent. So they, I was a beneficiary of that. But yeah, it was available everywhere in the world, except not the United States. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So many of the physicians who attend PEMBA are attending getting their MBA to become better physician leaders within healthcare organizations, payers. What, in your opinion, is the best way for healthcare systems and specifically physician leaders within healthcare systems to identify and support promising internal innovations from staff or physicians on their staff?
I got to tell you, I don't have that much experience with it. And I left two jobs, or I should say got kicked out of two jobs because I couldn't play institutional politics very well. I found change within the medical system to be absolutely unbearable, really. Absolutely unbearable. I mean, I'm in a field where they expect you to send all your patients to your surgeon, no matter whether he's good enough or not to do infant surgery. And when I didn't do that, I was told I wasn't a team player and I should go find another job. So I ended up going to private practice, which I never really wanted to do, but it was the only way I could responsibly in my own mind take care of the kids. So Mike, I can't speak to easy change within medical systems. I really can't. And the fact that they use this horrible electronic medical record shows how little influence physicians have on the business of medicine. I mean, it's uniformly despised by every doctor I know. And I looked at them for 3 years. I was reviewing disability claims. I had to use optical character recognition to find the chief complaint within an Epic EHR.
So is it, in your opinion, is it just the way that health systems are structured, the profit motive right now that are the biggest barriers to innovation? Because really healthcare, and you came through cardiac care for pediatrics, and the innovation and the revolution in pediatric cardiac surgery and interventional cardiology has just been astonishing.
It has.
So has that, would you say that the last 20 or 25 years and the changes in the payer system, or maybe better question is, what changes that have occurred in the last 30 years that do you think that have really stifled the innovation?
Oh, it's clearly the fact that when doctors owned their own practices, they were small businessmen and they treated their customers nicely with respect. After I went into private practice, I had a solo practice. No one ever got a voicemail. We didn't do voicemail. Someone always answered the phone. We took the one person who worked for us who had a really pleasant personality. She was our image to the outside community, and she answered the phone. And I always personally answered every single phone call I got within 24 hours. We were very customer service driven. Here in Tampa, I ended up getting a concierge PCP because I couldn't. The distance they place between you and your doctor now is unbelievable. At Tampa General, you have to wait sometimes 15 minutes to get a person who is not medically trained on the phone and have them tell you that you can't get an appointment for 3 months. My wife had budding case of infection in her leg, of syphilis. And I finally did what I did never wanted to do. I put on my MD cap. I called up infectious disease and I said, I am Dr. Marks. I have a patient who is developing very serious infection in her leg. She must be seen immediately, because everyone else said, go to urgent care. The urgent care people didn't know what to do with her. And even in urgent care, you would see a PA. You wouldn't see a doc. So the way medicine now is, I couldn't do it. I got out in the nick of time as far as I'm concerned.
So you are involved with academic systems right now through your tech transfer. How does that, is the academic environment able to foster technology development and innovation in a way that private sector can't? Or
that's a yes and a no. Like USF is a good example. They have an old-fashioned tech transfer office where their metric of success is how many patents they get. It's a terrible metric. And they have a single person running that office. They don't really have a wide breadth. So I said it, I made a task for myself. I said, you know, how does the tech transfer office get successful? So I joined this organization called the Association of University Technology Managers, AUTUM, went to their annual meeting, and I got a hold of their database and identified there maybe 20 successful tech transfer offices in the country. And I interviewed them and I recorded their interviews and I had AI make summaries of those interviews. And I'm preparing a report. I happened to met someone at the AIMBE meeting who is just one step below the vice provost for research. I discovered a couple of things. There have to be five different personalities in a tech transfer office. You got to have someone who assesses the technology and uses consultants when necessary. You have to have someone who gets patents. You have to get someone who writes licenses, someone who reaches, does corporate outreach, and someone who is on the phone selling. And they don't do that. They don't do that. None of them do it. It's amazing. There's only 20 successful tech transfer offices. I happens to be that my alma maters are among those 20. So anyway, I interviewed these people, made these reports. And this Friday, I have a meeting with this individual, and she is friends with the vice provost for research. And we're going to just give her the option. See, I don't have any p political skin in the game. I got nothing to lose. I'm doing this just because I think it's the right thing to do. And if she takes our recommendations, maybe there'll be some change there. But my partner in this, he's very pessimistic. He's an organizational psychologist, a PhD from Vanderbilt. He's been a well, anyway, Carrie's not as optimistic as I am. I tend to look at the brighter side. But I figure nothing ventured, nothing gained. I think it would be great if we could pull it off at USF. I mean, it's a great school. I didn't know very much about this school before I came down here, but it is a wonderful, wonderful school, beautiful school, you know.
Oh, that's great. Well, it sounds like you found a real niche down there for your passion for innovation and doing the tech transfer work. That's great.
Yep, I ended up
So,
doing what I was meant to do, strangely enough, in retirement.
for those of us that are sort of swimming upstream in healthcare organizations and trying to exert some physician leadership, is there any type of involvement for physician leaders, whether it's pilot projects or clinical research, that can really help speed the innovation process with medical technology or other new innovative approaches
Well,
to
people are trying
treating
to do that with
disease?
a they're trying to do it with AI now, but not the way I see, but the way it's getting used, I can't. It's horrible. I mean, I had a person from Microsoft tell me that they developed an AI practice. All you gotta do is put this phone down in between the doctor and the patient, and an entire medical record will be generated. I went, what? Where's the soap note? I want the soap note. So I'm looking for someone who's developing EMRs to try and work with them to develop a good one, but the fact of the matter is, they're not developed for physicians. They're developed for billing. That's what they're developed for. They're not developed to convey information in a concise way from one doctor to another. It's a shame. Doctors used to run hospitals. They don't do it anymore. It's a shame. I hope someone figures out a way. I really do, because it's a shame.
Well, I certainly, there are some, it's interesting to look at organizations, and of course, facilitating this leadership forum and the podcast, Pemba on Demand, I've interviewed several CEOs of organizations, and it is interesting to talk with them about how they think differently, how they lead differently than non-clinicians. And I've met some great RNs and other clinical staff who have just been phenomenal CEOs as well. So I guess maybe like you, I have a little bit more optimism that we can change things for the better by training people how to bridge that divide between the clinical world. In your case, you did it between the clinical and the engineering world. And I think the efforts going on to do that between leadership and operational positions and those types of things is, it gives me some optimism and hope, I
I
guess.
hope so. I hope so. I just don't see how, if profit motive is the driving force, how we can get there. That's the thing. I just don't see. I sit with people and I say, well, you should do this, but they say, but you won't make as much money. And I go, but you do it because it's better patient care or because you're being just a nice person. That doesn't register. Just doesn't register. So I hope you're right. I really do. I really do. I'm wrong a lot of the time. I hope I'm wrong on that too. Really.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about the focus on human factors engineering. I mean, we focus a lot on that in patient safety now.
Yes.
How do you incorporate that into your designs, whether they're medical patents or non-medical?
This is actually a great question, because most engineering companies that make products for medicine, you can tell that they never watched people actually using their products. And that drives me crazy. And even with my son in the ski pole, he says, well, look how easy it is to do this. I said, but how about a girl and who's just a new skier? You have to observe people actually using, whether it's a product or whether it's a system or something. You need to close the loop. You need it to become a servo mechanism where you see the result of what you're doing and how successful it is, and then keep modifying it and changing it till it performs better. And they just don't do that enough. And you can tell which products are in hospitals that were engineer-driven and doctors were barely involved in the process. So you'll get a Hewlett-Packard monitor. It's got like menus that go 10 levels deep. No doctor's ever going to go more than one level deep, you know? So they obviously didn't watch anyone actually using their monitor, and they need to watch people using their stuff. And engineers get impatient with people who don't think like engineers, because they can't say, why are you so dumb? Why can't you go down those four or five levels? And doctors, I hate to say it, but doctors are intimidated by engineers. They don't like being in a room with someone who knows more than they do about something. So they're very hard to get those groups to communicate. That's where I live. I live in that wasteland in between there.
So going back to your comment on the getting the physicians involved, and you mentioned this with the EMRs too, and Don just put a comment in the chat about what if you could, what would you change? How would you make the EHRs and EMRs less focused on billing and more focused on communicating concepts, ideas?
That's actually easy. I had the best EMR in the world when I was in practice. It was a Windows folder with the patient's ID number on it. Within that was every document, every letter I dictated was dictated with macros in Microsoft Word. So for common phrases, I could expand them, but I never did a whole letter so I would dictate it. It would come back to me. It would maybe be this big, and then whoosh, it would turn into a letter. Every new letter was based on the prior letter. I could find anything with my electronic health record. All I had to do is type in coarctation of the order, and every single patient who had coarctation would pop up on the screen. Mm-hmm. But there's no money in using Windows to keep track of patients. So they have these crazy things, and I understand it. It's a lot is to justify billing. But I didn't actually answer your question. How I would design one is it would be a soap note. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a reason soap notes became the standard, because soap notes are wonderful. They're perfect. Subjective, objective assessment plan. It's the way every medical, I mean, can you imagine in Epic Records, you know how far into that record you got to go to find the physical exam or to find the chief complaint? And people are so disgusted with, you know what common chief complaint is nowadays? Patient is doing well. And because a level three, to bill a level three, you're supposed to do a full physical exam. No one could do that. So they check off a template with normal. I can't tell you how many patients I saw when I was reviewing these charts who had amputations, but musculoskeletal system was checked off as normal. That didn't happen once. That happened 10, 15 times, because they just check off normal for the template so they could bill a level three. Crazy. Why do they want a super subspecialist to do a complete H&P? Makes no sense. I don't get it. I just don't get it.
Yeah, I think that it's a lot of the expectations, and it's evolved over time, but it seems like we've gotten into a situation where we're doing it because they want to prove that you've spent a certain amount of time with the patient, that you've done a careful investigation, rather than coming up with the right diagnosis. And we focus more on the amount of effort you put into it rather than getting the outcome that the patient really deserves.
Why should a dermatologist have to listen to your heart? I mean, I don't get it. What's the point? Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the point? I mean, if they had an infinite amount of time, maybe, but if they got 15, 20 minutes, you want them to look at your skin for 15, 20 minutes. It's an idiotic system, really. It's a completely idiotic system.
So I'm going to have to give a disclaimer at the end of this that our opinions aren't the opinions of Dr. Leiter or the University of Tennessee, because we're getting into some pretty controversial topics here.
Yeah, you're right.
So getting back to the idea of innovation, and I know that you do a lot of mentorship. What do you find is the most common piece of advice that you give to young students who are trying to become inventors, yeah, trying to develop patents? What advice do you find they're most in need of today?
The business schools in this country do a terrible job teaching IP. Absolutely disgraceful. They have award-winning entrepreneurship program here at University of Tampa. It's one of the top 10 in the country. They don't teach IP. So first thing I do is, I mean, they give them like one lecture or something. This next week, I was invited to the Entrepreneurs Club to give my experience of why IP is important. And as you can tell from our prior conversation, it's pretty important to me. And if they bite, they take the bait. I've already created a 14-class curriculum, and I will invite patent attorneys and trademark attorneys to come speak, and they will be happy to do so and even sponsor the event so they can hand out their business cards. That's one huge one. I have spoken to so many kids who are literally going bankrupt, starting companies, and they have an idea that if it's successful, a major corporation will just simply take it away from them. And that is a horrible thing to see.
So IP is intellectual property for
people
who aren't property. Familiar with
patents,
that.
Trademarks, with copyrights.
Yeah. And so it sounds like they are really at risk for losing control of their idea because they're not protecting it properly.
Correct. That's the one thing. The other thing is that I always have to tell people you can't fall too much in love with your idea. Entrepreneurs don't want to hear bad news. It's a funny thing. I won't mention particular cases, but there's some that are very close to me that drive me crazy. They won't do a clinical trial to test it in that area because, frankly, they're afraid that the trial will come back negative. And they've fallen in love with this thing, and it's part of their soul. They don't want to hear bad news. But you got to hear the bad news, you know, because otherwise you're going to waste a lot of time, money, and end up with nothing. I know one poor guy. He thinks he's going to reinvent the way people find movies and music to listen to. And he doesn't have anything that's protected. And he's bankrupt. He's actually spent all of his money on this. He spent a couple of $100,000 having software built. He will never make a dime. Wow. It's tragic.
Yeah. So is the intellectual property advice that you're giving now, is that the same advice that you wish you had gotten 30 years ago? Or there other advice that would have been more helpful to you?
Absolutely. A big change took place about 15 years ago. The United States joined an international patent convention. It used to be first to invent, and now it's first to file. It's a big difference for the basement inventor. You have to file a provisional patent every time you get an idea. And I came up with an idea in medical school for a way to create 3D motion picture x-rays. I won't go into the detail technically, but when I was a cath lab director, I finally could test it. It worked. And I gave a great presentation at the Radiologic Society of North America, where I gave everybody in the audience red and green things to hold in front of their eyes, and they could see giant objects floating in space and stuff. Well, anyway, I filed a patent application, and the patent examiner is not really acting on it very well. And then my patent attorney, who I love to death, he said, let's have an office interview. And the patent examiner's looking really sheepish. And he says, I forgot to mention something to you. So Sheba filed the patent on this. I said, when did they file it? And back then, it was first to invent for U.S. inventors, first to file for foreign inventors. I go digging through all my trash and everything to find something. They had filed 3 weeks before the first documentation I could come up with. It was my idea. And 2 years later, I'm an American Heart meeting and I go to the Toshiba booth, rotational angiography. That was a killer. Yeah, I sure do wish someone had given me advice. I would have done a lot of things differently. And that's how I sell myself as a consultant. I say, I've made every mistake in the book, so I can help other people from making the same mistakes. You know?
Well, this has been great, Lloyd. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us tonight. We're kind of at the end of time, so we'll wrap it up. But is there anything that you had wanted to focus on that we really didn't get a chance to talk about that you'd like to say before we close out?
Not really. I mean, look, as we discussed earlier, Pemba is not really targeted for entrepreneurs necessarily, but I still got a lot out of the program. I really did. I learned how to read a spreadsheet. I have to thank Bruce Spain tremendously. I was able to create a pro forma with everything in it, taxes, all those things I can't remember anymore, all the parameters that we can derive. And so it's very rich to have knowledge. You don't have to be an expert. I always tell people, I'm not so smart. I just speak three languages. And that's really what the secret is for me.
I remember you sharing with me that one of the other things you felt like you really took away was just the relationships that you built with Pemba. And you still rely on those today when you have ideas.
I'll make a shout out to JP. I mean, JP helped me with an anesthesia device. Someone was going to vent something. I thought it was useless. I called him up and he said to me, are you kidding? No one's ever going to use that device. I called the IP guy running the tech transfer office at Stevens Institute. I told him, and he said the political pressure was so great, I had to file a patent on it. Hmm. But it was great, you know, because it was an excuse to get back in touch with him and to catch up a little bit. And he gave me that advice, which was wonderful. Yeah.
Well, that's great. That's great.
We had a great group. We had a fun group. We really did.
Yeah, I have so many fond memories looking back at Pemba and just enjoying the residency periods there. And it was just fabulous.
Tom Brown is, I mean, what can I say? Tom Brown is he's an angel. He's an absolute angel. You know, what a man. Love that guy.
Yeah.
Absolutely love that guy. It was a great experience.
Well, thank you again, Lloyd. Thank you for taking the time to join us tonight on our Pemba On Demand live stream. This is the first live stream that we've done at this time of the evening at 6 p.m. We will be having more live streams discussing topics relevant to you as physician leaders, and we'll also be releasing the content from the live streams as podcasts, and we'll be releasing those biweekly. Information on the podcast and how you can subscribe and access the podcast will be available on all the major podcast players such as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. So a big thank you to the team at University of Tennessee, Kate Ashley, who's the Executive Director, Healthcare Division of Graduate and Executive Education at the Haslam College of Business, and Dr. Don Leiter, professor at the University of Tennessee, now retired, but also has been involved with the Institute for Healthcare Quality Research and Education for both of their support. A big shout out also to Tom Brown, Sharath Sreeman, and Christy Napper for their help in putting the branding together and making the show what it is. We hope you will join us again next month for another live stream on the third Tuesday of May. We look forward to seeing you there.
Pemba On Demand is released biweekly every other Thursday and available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castos, or Overcast. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast player by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could share the podcast with your friends or colleagues. You can also listen to our podcasts on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PembaOn-demand, all one word, no spaces. Please hit the like button and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments or questions regarding this or other episodes, please feel free to add them into the comment section on our YouTube channel. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to our website and our YouTube channel in the show notes. The website is tiny.utk.edu/PembaOnDemand, all one word. There's no hyphen in that URL. You will find the links to the episodes there. Please also check the show notes for links that were discussed in the show today. Take good care of yourselves and become an even bigger force for good in healthcare.